This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
I'm with Anne Lawler, co-founder and chairperson of 22Q11 Ireland. Hi Anne, can you tell us a little bit about 22Q11 deletion syndrome and how it impacts sleep, first of all?
22Q11.2 deletion syndrome is the most common microdeletion known to man. It's a microdeletion of perhaps between 30 and 40 genes on the Q arm of the 22nd chromosome. I like to be quite precise about that because there is also a duplication, and when you move further down that chromosome, you're talking about other conditions, but it's a very specific condition by itself. So there's lots of interesting aspects to it. Very few children are diagnosed in the first year of life for various reasons. It's a multi-system condition, so it can impact on any of the bodily systems, congenital heart defects, kidney, gastrointestinal issues, and so on and so forth. It's quite significantly variable. Sleep can be impacted for a number of reasons. Some of those can be physical. The children might have undiagnosed sleep apnea. VPI, velopharyngeal incompetence, is another palate condition that can interfere with sleep. Reflux, undiagnosed reflux. For instance, I didn't know my daughter had reflux until she was in her mid-20s. And that's extraordinary to me because she had a diagnosis at 15 and no one thought to check for reflux. Leg pains is a huge issue. We still do not know why leg pains occur in children with 22Q. It can be a calcium deficiency, vitamin D. Again, these are things that need to be checked regularly. So when a child with 22Q presents, either diagnosed or undiagnosed, those are things that would need to be carefully looked at. The other thing that very often goes under the radar is separation anxiety. Children with 22Q can be highly anxious. In their younger years, they tend to have various phobias, insects, spiders, that kind of thing. They're concrete, literal thinkers. So, for instance, if you said to a child, I remember a child being told once, because she was hoarse and she was coughing, an adult said to the child, "Oh, you have a frog in your throat." And the child took that literally and screamed, woke up screaming during the night, asking mammy to get the frog out of her throat. It's like the Piaget stage of development that children with 22Q tend to stay in longer. So it's difficult to untangle, and you need to dig deep sometimes to get to the issues, especially around sleep. And sometimes it's a simple remedy, sometimes it's not. Some parents have reverted to going to prescription medication, most commonly melatonin. Sometimes that doesn't work. I think perhaps maybe with the new area of precision medicine, that might change. Obviously, it's like for all of us, some medications will affect people differently and have an adverse, and so it could be some of that. Sleep can also resolve itself in a lot of ways, especially if the medical issues are taken care of, and then they can reoccur a lot in teenage years. And again, you cannot just look at the sleep issue in isolation. It's quite possible that there's something going on in school. Quite a number of our children are bullied. They might have school refusal. They don't want to, and it's difficult to get to the bottom of it, because at that age they don't often have the capacity to explain bullying or how it's happening or what's happening. They don't know how to negotiate their peer relationships. A common occurrence with children with 22Q is that they don't initiate friendships. They tend to graviate towards younger children or adults for their social interactions. They tend not to get along with peer age typical children.
And you mentioned your own experiences with raising a child both with 22q and with sleeping problems. Mm-hmm. How have your experiences of raising Anya informed your work with 22q and what in Ireland?
Oh, hugely, Stacey, because it's the case of knowing about something and knowing something because you live with it. And they're two different things. I think a good clinician, for instance, would, if they had a child with 22q as their patient, a good clinician would read extensively about the condition and how it might be impacting on this particular child, because they're all impacted differently. But they still won't have that knowledge that comes from living with something, the lived experience, as I call it. And this is where parent and clinician can work very closely together and kind of work towards better or best outcomes for the child. Because, and invariably, it's the mother. I'm always quite wryly amused when I hear parental interventions. Parental, invariably, it's the mother. And I think if we supported the mother in particular, we'd have better outcomes for everything. But that's me speaking as a mother. But Anya still informs me, Stacey. I'm still learning from Anya. You learn everything. You cannot know in advance about this condition. You can only grow with it as your child has grown and grow into it as your child has grown. So, she still informs me greatly. And our hope is now that our young adults with 22q will inform policy and practice as we move forward.
What can professionals learn from your experience as a parent and from the experiences of these young adults who will hopefully inform policy and practice?
There's an expression that goes around when you hear hooves, think zebras. Because usually when you hear hooves, you think of horses. So think a little outside the box. You know, as a professional, don't go for the obvious, maybe, answer. You know, talk. I remember one 22q expert who every parent, every mother, was really taken with this profession, because he said the first thing you do when you're taking on a child with 22q as one of your patients is you listen very carefully to the mother. So I think professionals need to listen a little bit more and maybe acknowledge that parents have an expertise that they don't have. And I would have done all of those things that were asked of me, and none of them worked, because there was an underlying genetic cause for all of her problems, including her sleep problems, that I didn't know about. So, and the other thing a professional could maybe keep in mind is that parents might come in defensive or belligerent. Underneath it, they're afraid and they're looking for your help and your support.
And there's lots of room to work together. We were talking last week about the impact of co-production and how it could impact services, and I think that applies to sleep, mental health and many other areas.
It applies to everything. I was listening to the difficulty that some professionals are finding with getting parents on board. I think we need to involve our parents more. You know, maybe if clinics were co, or presentations were co, if they were... one of the things I'd like to see, and we've done some basic research work on this, is developing parent psychosocial education training program. But the idea is that it would be delivered by a parent and a clinician. Parents will listen to other parents. Do you know, there isn't that mythical them and us barrier. So you need to level the playing field and do away with the barriers before you get parents on board. And parents have to be seem to be, you know, able, capable, You know, if you start off your relationship with, you know, I'm in this up down position where perhaps this parent is not really capable. Parents are very capable. We're very capable people. We just need extra skills sometimes.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.